you see, the atomic structure, if an individual is going into outer space, the atomic structure must be absolutely clean. Because, as Mr. Carr just pointed out, when you go into outer space, when you pass the certain atmospheric boundaries, then there is a moment of transition. If a person is traveling in their physical body, and the physical body is not perfectly clean, so far as the atoms are concerned, then it would cause death. In other words, the physical body would simply shatter in going through this moment of transition. However, if the karma, which causes the accumulation in the atoms, has been transmuted, then anyone with that sort, that's what we call an ascended body, then any person with that sort of a body can travel anywhere they wish. But the catch there is that at that point they don't need a spaceship. They can travel within their own force field, which is what a spaceship is. A spaceship is a mechanical force field. But we have our own force fields, which operate on exactly the same principle. And I believe that that explains why Mr. Carr has been successful in developing his inventions, because he has followed universal law in all respects. And that's the way spaceships are built on other planets. They're built according to natural principles.
Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Carr.
You're a little closer to the microphone.
I would like to call attention to our brochure, which, as you know, was put into process last June of 1957. In the closing pages, we carry a paragraph. And we live by the statement of this paragraph, and if it is not out of order, I'd like to read it. It's the policy of OTC, and has been since we were conceived, and it states this: imagination and creative ability among our assets, for which no definite limit exists. The creator of the universe has a complete monopoly on power, atomic or otherwise. Many lasting inventions originate in the minds of individuals from all levels of society, of all degrees of temperament. Thus, discovery can come from economical sources as well as from the chambers of wisdom. A new age of energy application is upon us. An understandable knowledge of spiritual transition and material transmutation is at the threshold. This new age of science, discovery and adventure is indeed thrilling as we find ways to realize that energy is perpetual, matter is perpetual, and life is perpetual.
Incidentally, I should break in and offer a public apology to Mrs. Storm, because as she says, as an author myself, I know that if someone took the manuscript of my book and read a couple of sentences out of context, they might sound very funny. And I do apologize, ma'am.
Thank you.
Well, while apologies are going around, as the party responsible for getting these review manuscripts into being and into Long John's hands in time for the members of the panel to read them and have some general acquaintance at least with them, I'll admit that while we work day and night to try to get them up here a few days ahead, they were only delivered to us from the printer at about 2 o'clock this afternoon. And we brought them up here, of course, some hours before showtime, but these people did not have access to them until, as John said, minutes prior, so that even had they wanted to read the entire manuscript, they could not have up to this time.
Yes, I'll agree with you, Mr. Colton. That makes it rather difficult. I'd like to take a moment to talk with Mrs. Storm again. I would also like to apologize because, for a moment, Mrs. Storm, I broke up when Charles read that, the first part of the first sentence there. And it, I don't know, it just touched me off a little bit there. I would like to know, too. I would like to ask you this, Mrs. Storm. I think you just mentioned something about the manner of manufacturing spacecraft on other planets. I think you told us something about that, the method of manufacturing. Is that right?
Yes, I mentioned it. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned it. Now, where do you get this information?
Why? A lot of it comes from the gentleman, Mr.
Matthews?
Mr. Leedham. Is that still the name?
That's right.
Charles Leedham?
Yes. The gentleman he just mentioned, Al Maria, the Chohan of the First Row. These are adepts who are connected with our planet and other planets.
Well, let me ask you this. Is this similar to Indian guides and mentors, as Mark Probert would talk about?
Absolutely no connection whatsoever.
I didn't mean a connection with his mentors or anything like that, but is this a matter of a medium going into a trance?
No. I do not hold with such things at all. This has no connection. That is connected with the astral plane, and we do not deal with that.
You mean Probert and Mrs. Brady
dealing with any
medium?
Any medium. There are only two people fall into one class or the other. They can take up mediumship or they can take up discipleship. And you can't do both. You can't have both. Mediumship deals with the astral plane. Only with that we have nothing to do.
Evidently, you've said something that just didn't hit home with me. I'm still trying to find out where you get this information. You've told me who you get it from,
mm-hmm.
who gives it to you, but you don't tell me how.
Well, it comes in various ways. A great deal of it is published and may be obtained in magazines, in books, and so forth.
You mean that particular line that Charles Leedham read originally, that information has been published in books or magazines?
Well, a great deal of information has certainly been published in books and magazines about Moria and all of the other adepts who are Chohans of the race. A Chohan simply means a great adept or in other words, this earth is not just simply spinning around here under its own power.
Uh-huh.
It is under a system of government, which is sometimes referred to as the government of the solar system. The solar systems, in turn, are...
When you say the government, are you referring to the people in Washington?
No, nothing to do with Washington. I am referring to a universal government. If you wish to call it a government, it's not the government in the sense that the government at Washington functions. I mean, it's not a fiscal affair. But the cosmic rays, there are seven cosmic rays connected with this planet.
With the Earth?
With the Earth, yes.
Seven. How about other planets like Venus and Mars? Do they also have seven? Or more or less?
Venus has 12. And
is there a reason?
Yes, there is a reason, because Venus is... the people on Venus are much more highly advanced. And the planet is much nearer the completion of its evolution. And contrary to the belief of astronomers, Venus is not in this solar system, and neither is Mars. These solar systems are, so to speak, stacked up one on top of the other, you might say. And Venus, the Earth, and Mars happen to be the fourth planet out in each case from their respective sun. We do not see the sun on the sun around which Venus revolves or around which Mars revolves because of the adjustment of our physical eyesight. Now, let me see. You ask if these things were...
Well, I'll try that. At this moment, I'm very confused. I'm not even going to ask you anything about the 12 and the 7, but I'm going to add them up and play that number tomorrow morning. That's the number, baby. Believe me. Get on that one. What I do want to ask you again, I wonder if you can tell me in 2 and 3 syllable words, even stick to 2 syllable words if possible, how do you get this information?
Well, I can only repeat that a great deal of it is available in books which have been published over...
No, in other words, didn't...
A matter of a century or so, and also it's available in magazines which are currently published, month by month. Some of it isn't available...
I haven't made myself clear. Where is the line? I'm not trying to read this.
Well, let me get a question here, Mrs. Storm. That is... I hope you will pardon me if I find this title a little humorous, because I've never run into it before. Not the title Mrs. Storm, but the title Chohan of the First Ray. I am amused
maybe
by
you just the... Maybe you just haven't been reading the right book.
This is probably it. My reading has been certainly limited in the past. But if I find the titles of many of the sort of earthly lodges a little humorous at times, the grand commanders and so forth, the various things. But if Mr. Moria came to my office and my secretary said the Chohan of the First Ray is here to see you, I might...
Well, in the first place, he wouldn't be coming to your office. And in the second place, if he did, by any chance, come, I'm sure that he would not introduce himself in that way. Because he would know that you would not understand.
Mr. Storm, perhaps I can ask an accurate question here. You
go to a better library than I do, Don.
You have just said that Venus is not part of our solar system, and I would like to know simply where you got this information. I mean,
well,
scientific textbooks say Venus revolves around our sun.
I said before I made that statement that contrary to the belief of our astronomers. Now, I have said about three times, I think, and I guess I'll have to repeat it a fourth, that all of this information is available in published books, magazines, weekly bulletins, and so forth.
The question should be then, where do the people who write these articles that appear in the magazines get the information? I hope that they wouldn't say that they're getting it from other books or magazines.
Why, it is stepped down. I mean, a great deal of the information that I am referring to is written by such a man as Moria himself.
Is this a man, an earthling?
He lives here. And
when you say here, in
on the earth? No, he does not. He lives in India, up above Darjeeling.
Do you have any idea about how old this man is?
Why, I believe he's a few hundred years old.
A few hundred years old?
Yes.
Have many people had the opportunity of interviewing this man?
I understand a great many have, yes. I believe that he has spent considerable time in England and in other countries, and I believe he's quite well known. Naturally, he only... is known among persons who understand these matters and who are interested in them. He is not going around making his knowledge public to those who do not have any interest in them.
May I make an observation,
Mr. Carr,
John?
Yes.
The arcane, the mystical, and the esoteric are never secret. However, obtaining this information is a matter of following a path. And therefore, this information is always available. And any seeker, any neophyte who tries or is interested in learning will be guided with tremendous kindness, care, and love. The answers cannot always come so quickly.
You sound like you're pretty familiar with this, Mr. Carr.
The great Mr. Tesla enlightened us in many ways.
We weren't talking about Tesla at the moment.
Well, he
was talking about this man in India.
And Mr. Tesla himself...
He was a friend of Tesla's.
...was one of these...
This man...
Tesla knew all of these things.
That's the Oh, if we only had television.
If we only had picture radio.
It's the funniest
thing
in history.
This is the funniest thing I've ever seen. Even Norm flipped when he said it.
You've got to describe it, John.
Why, you fellas are smothering these laughs for a moment. It's very interesting to me to see and hear what's going on, and I do flip occasionally because I have a funny bone like anybody else. And while under the title of sales engineering, most of my work deals with $20 million and electromagnets and wires and markets and motivation research and all of the other things that go into it, in the course of learning and preparing myself to deal with these matters and checking out the sources of information as part of the research, I've had many very interesting surprises in the past year. Among which, I find that no living scientist or no scientist of recorded history has created any living thing, even such a simple living thing as an amoeba, the simplest of all forms of life. And yet, as Mr. Carr has pointed out to me, and as I have read more about in various books, such primitive forms of life, or as we term them, primitive, as the crustacea, when they lose a member, are able, of their own body processes, to grow a new member, even though in some cases it's highly complex, like the foreclaw of a lobster. And so, as Mr. Carr has also pointed out, maybe the only reason we can't grow a new arm when we lose one is because we have so much sense, we know we can't do it. The lobster grows a new arm because he hasn't got enough sense to know he can't. Some of these things, in their mystification of my neophyte mind, have left that mind wide open for more investigation and a hope for better understanding of some of these things you're reading about out of Mrs. Storm's book. Instead of agnosticism, I have switched all the other way around to an attitude of believing what I have not seen disproved.
That's an interesting statement, to say the least.
But don't disappoint the people by not telling him what Don did that set that off.
That was
beautiful.
Yeah, I think you should.
You want me to do this?
Yeah.
Well, when Mrs. Storm said that this several hundred year old gentleman.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the dial.
Moria.
This is Moria.
El Moria.
Very same Moria.
No hand of the first ray.
When he said that, she said that Moria was a friend of Tesla, Don here, with a perfectly straight face, picked up the book on Tesla and started looking in the index.
Oh, Moria,
or Matthews, or Carr. Or Mr. Zorth, who sent the telegram in, that's a disciple either. This Tesla had a lot of unknown friends.
I'm sorry to interrupt at this time, but we have a little business to take care of.
Otis T. Carr and Norman Evans Colton. Mr. Carr is the president of OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland. Mr. Colton is director of sales engineering. Ellery Lanier, the fact editor of Fantastic Science Fiction, was going to join us, but unfortunately he is ill. We hope that maybe he's at least listening and maybe he's enjoying. Charles Leadham, author and TV producer, is with us. Mr. Leadham is the author of the book that'll soon be available in your bookstores, published by Scribner, titled Dog Obedience Training. And Don Dunn of Television Age is with us. And now back with our guests of the morning. Don, I think you're looking through Mr. O'Neill's book, and you've heard some of the comments that, some of the statements that have been made by Mrs. Storm. I was wondering if you had any questions.
Not on Gloria right now. I would like to get back to the...
May you just accept this?
I have the feeling, John, I wouldn't be able to get much that I would understand.
By asking
further questions on that. I would like to get back to the OTCX1, going back to the brochure again. Mr. Colton, I imagine you wrote the sentence at the top of this page, which says in nice red letters, "We have invented a fourth-dimensional space vehicle." I would like to know in what way the OTCX1 is a fourth-dimensional vehicle.
Yeah.
I would like to know just what this means.
I would like to shunt that question off to Mr. Carr, because as I have prefaced many of my remarks, I have little education in the physical sciences. I'm trying to grow with them. My introduction to Francis Bacon about a year ago and his 27 prerogative instances of nature has set me a course that probably take a rest of a lifetime to catch up with.
Before, Mr. Colton, when we were talking about the figures, you were reading various figures from a magazine on the cost it was going to involve in building a satellite and getting a man to the moon. You mentioned that these companies that were going to build these had high figures because they were working with principals, I believe. You said that they knew little about.
I said I presumed that because they set these blue sky figures on their projected accomplishments,
mm-hmm.
that they didn't know how they were going to go about them or what they were going to use to do them with.
Well,
we know exactly what our components consist of,
mm-hmm.
and what they cost down to the per pound price of copper, iron, how much it costs to wind a coil, how much it costs to turn out a Utron electrical accumulator mm-hmm. on a lathe.
I just wanted to say that in the article on the Air Force Dinosaur ship that is being built, it says right here the Dinosaur is a boost glide vehicle designed to use both aerodynamic lift and centrifugal force. The principles of aerodynamic lift, I'm sure you are well aware with, that is what holds an airplane up, and
right.
centrifugal force. The plane is obviously intended to be caught in a gravitational pull and orbit in space. Now, in the page here on the OTCX-1, it does not say it is using aerodynamic lift. It says the Utron electric accumulator generates its own power, which is electromagnetism and electromotive force. I just wonder, can these principles be explained as easily as aerodynamic lift?
I think so. It's a tremendous big question of many parts. Before I turn it over to Mr. Carr, there are a few things I think I do know about these forces and their functions. In the first place, this term centrifugal force has been misused and misunderstood very extensively. The satellite vehicles that are orbiting now around this planet are usually said to be orbiting because of centrifugal force. And this is not so. They are describing an orbital path that is influenced partly by centrifugal force, but the force that keeps them in motion is the free space energy that is the propellant fuel of Mr. Carr's devices.
I understood the force that kept the satellite in motion was the first push that's given by the third stage on the rockets. The fact that the this free space motion is the first I've heard.
Yeah, well, that's why I think this is a good opportunity to air this question and its proper answer, because that is a common misconception. The first push and Newton's law, which explains what is happening, stops right there at what is happening and not how it is happening or why it is caused to happen. The object is set in motion and is put into orbit because of its push. Mm-hmm. But if you turn in your brochure there to the insert fly leaf, mm-hmm. you'll read the explanation and the basic law which Mr. Carr first published with this brochure, and which, to my knowledge, is the first publication of the physical fact and the universal law by which these devices are propelled in this orbit.
As I said, the reason I directed these questions to you, Mr. Colton, was I understood that you had done the actual writing on this. Now, perhaps we can get an answer from Mr. Carr as to the propulsion unit in the OTCX-1.
The technical part of these, as relates to the science, is directed by me to Mr. Colton in all of these writings and in all of our literature relating to science. As relates to our particular devices, which is the neutron electrical accumulator and the corroded gravity motor, you asked first about the fourth dimensional. And this to us is very simple, because we say that the fourth dimension is defined by the curve, that the dimensions of pressure are straight lines, and the dimension of motion is a curvature. There are three straight lines of dimension, the horizontal, angle, the vertical, and in motion they are the curve. So therefore it is fourth. Now when we say it's a fourth dimensional vehicle, it's because it's completely round and completely square.
The vehicle is completely round and completely square.
It's power unit, yes. That's what gets it up
frankly,
in the air.
I do not understand how it can be completely round and completely square.
This, in its angular dimension...
Mr. Carr has a model of one of the units.
In its angular dimensions, it is completely square. In its curved dimensions, it is completely round.
I see. Mr. Carr, there is a statement right here that, frankly, to me, sounds unfinished. It says, I'm reading it from your brochure again. It says, some tests were independently made by qualified engineers mm-hmm. at one of America's leading plants. It was estimated that a small model, only 4 inches in diameter, produced energy equivalent to 1,000 tons.
Mm-hmm. Of pressure. Now,
It does not say of pressure. It says energy equivalent to 1,000 tons.
Well, the word pressure was meant.
Pressure
in
weight.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I did not know that energy was measured in weight.
It takes energy to move weight, so it can be measured in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lost.
I'm with you.
We're
not going to be lost. I want everybody to hold everything.
I'll think this over.
Can I, excuse me.
Well, did you have a...
This is a moderately complicated thing. I don't know if we can fit it in before the coffee break.
Well, I was wondering if maybe we better take the break now. Because I know that everybody is very anxious to get a chance to ask questions.
Yeah, I've got a couple of rip doozers here, but they're a little thick setup time, you know.
Let me take just a moment first before we get back into this discussion, because I got something to peddle.
WOR Radio, 710 on the dial in New York.
We're talking this morning with Mrs. Margaret Stan,
author of the new book entitled Return of the Dove, Ellery Lanier, fact editor of Fantastic Science Fiction, was supposed to be with us this morning, but he is ill. We hope he's listening and maybe he feels a little better. Charles Leadham, author and TV producer, is with us, and Don Dunn of Television Age. We're sitting around this morning talking with Norman Colton and Otis T. Carr. I have a couple of telegrams here. Here's one from Maplewood, New Jersey. Everything all right, Doc Nielsen? I just mentioned I did, yes. This is WOR Radio, your station in New York. My name is Al Nielsen, filling in for Long John.
Maplewood, New Jersey, from Jerry Gilbert. Vanguard given final push by spring released by fuse, not by third stage.
Oh, my.
Jerry.
That's a good idea.
Jerry.
John, I think there is possibly a spring or a fuse arrangement that gets the Vanguard separated from the third stage, but it's the 18,000-mile-an-hour push is certainly from the third stage, not from the spring.
Well, I'm not going to argue the point with you, Don. You possibly know more about it than I do, but I understand that they worked it with rubber bands.
Well, it might be the
reason for all those
sort of a slingshot arrangement.
Security precautions are they don't want newsmen to see the guys, you know, just before the takeoff down there winding that little key in the side. I mean, that would be very embarrassing.
Well, no, that's a 24-hour spring, you know, on that.
So they can wind it up the night before.
Yeah. That's why. Here's a comment from Cranford, New Jersey. This morning's program is putrid. Yes. Terry J. Dempsey. Thank you, Mr. Dempsey. We read them all. We don't care. Thank you, Mr. Dempsey. Here's one from Yonkers. This gentleman has requested me not to use his name. I happen to know who the man is, so we will respect his wish, and we will not mention his name. Long John and Mr. Leadham. Could there be a symbolism in Mr. Carr's device? Could a square talk in circles?
Very good.
Very good. That's excellent. I think we should bring our listeners up to date. Otis T. Carr is the president of OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland. OTC Enterprises is an organization. We are told that their main office is located in Baltimore. And I have in front of me a brochure that's been published by the OTC Enterprises Incorporated. They claim that they have the know-how to manufacture a circular foil craft that will go to the moon in a period of 5 hours. And if you don't want to stay up there, you can orbit around and come back 5 hours later. They will build this craft for $20 million. If you place an order with OTC Enterprises for two, the second one will only cost $4 million. Each additional one, $4 million. But the first one, $20 million. They also intend to manufacture some other devices, such as the Corato gravity machine, the Utron electric battery, some solar energy devices, electromagnetic machinery, and the gravity electric generator. Now, I imagine some people who are listening this morning, maybe you've joined us for the first time, you're wondering if we're pulling your leg a little bit, if this is for real or what. Well, I can assure you one thing, that we have a number of models up here. We also have a beautiful painting of the OTC plant, the research building, and various other buildings, which haven't been built up to this date, but I imagine they will be as soon as the organization continues. In fact, I've just received a telepathic communication from William E. Preston, Jr., and he tells me it is not a painting, it's a rendering, meaning to tear apart, I guess. So that'll bring you up to date. And from this point, well, I think we also should add that Mrs. Storm, the author of the new book, Return of the Dove,
as a lady that believes that she knows people who are able to communicate with Tesla. Mr. Tesla died
in 1943. Am I correct in making that statement?
Well, what do you
think? I was thinking in terms of, I was thinking about Matthews up in Canada.
Oh, well, that's not since Tesla died. That was when he was alive.
Well, who was the man, the last time that I spoke to you, who was the man that you told me?
I think you said to me that some man in Canada or in England was communicating with Tesla since he's been dead.
Tesla.
With the machine, with the radio machine or something, if you could describe it.
No, no. The only radio type machine, which was invented by Tesla, was built by Mr. Matthews. And he has not communicated with Tesla. He communicates with the crews from the spaceship. Mr. Matthews stated at one point that while Tesla was alive, he did not necessarily have to communicate with him by letter. He had other ways of communicating with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill Preston just walked in, and Bill just came over, and he whispered to me that he was listening to the program, and he had some work to do and a couple of assignments. He thought the discussion was very interesting, and he hopped into his Jaguar and came from the studio in Westport. Bill, I'll give up my seat for a couple of minutes if you want to jump in here and ask a couple of questions.
I came down to see if it was for real.
All right.
You've been told it was a man.
No. This is Mrs. Storm. This is Don Dunn. Mr. Norman Colton. Mr. Otis T. Carr. And our boy, Leadham.
Mrs. Storm, I heard the show the last time that you were on some months ago. And am I correct in assuming that you have never seen any of these instruments which communicate with Venus, these radio-type machines?
Well, the radio-type machine does not communicate with Venus, the present model. It's a radio-type set which was designed by Tesla in 1938. The design was given to Arthur H. Matthews, who was one of his engineers, lived near Quebec, Canada. Tesla said to Mr. Matthews, in a few years, spaceships will be approaching the Earth from other planets. And when they do, I would suggest that you build this set so that you can speak to the crews. It is called an interplanetary communication set, and I understand that in its final phase, it will be able to fly communication with other planets. At the present time, however, Matthews has built a smaller model, which has a range of from 5,000 miles above the Earth to 30,000 miles. In other words, a spaceship must be within that range in order to be reached by this set.
Have you seen this set?
I personally have not gone up there yet to see it. However, many of my friends have.
Has this set picked up any messages from spacecraft?
Yes. It picked up messages immediately after he had it built.
Messages from flying saucers, or what we would call flying saucers?
That is correct. And then after the first, I think about the first five messages had been received, the pilot of the ship said that he would come down, he would land. And the first, since that, there have been many landings. Mr. Matthews' property is quite secluded, and it's heavily wooded and so forth. And he has a space, an open space, fairly near his home, which is a natural landing field of sorts. And there, these spacecraft often come down at night, and he is able to visit with his crew.
This particular radio type machine, it would seem that possibly this might be of tremendous interest, let's say, to the United States government or the Canadian government.
I don't think it would be the slightest interest to anyone. As I explained before when I was here, it is nothing more than a gadget. It's like a telephone. If you're going to use a telephone, you've got to have somebody on the other end of it. If you're going to use this machine, it's not going to do you any good unless somebody up there in a spaceship decides that they would like to talk with you.
Well, in other words, since these spaceships are traveling around occasionally, and then this gentleman seems to pick up quite a few messages, it would seem it might be of value. We've always had this thing that the one reason that they are afraid to land in public places is because of the fact that there would be panic on the part of the people and so forth. Well, possibly the governments might be able to assure these space visitors, alleged space visitors, that by means of this communication device, that actually they were free to land and we would not harm them if this would be the case.
Well, this doesn't happen to be the case because the United States government has definitely issued orders to jet pilots to fire on spaceships. And the same orders have been issued by the government of Great Britain, and there are several known instances where the jet pilots did fire on a spaceship. The government does not want the spaceships to land. There is no feeling of friendliness whatsoever, but complete hostility. And the governments of the world have not released the information which they have on the spaceships, but they deny that flying saucers exist.
Well, possibly this whole thing might be due to a lack of communication.
There's no lack of communication.
There is a lack of communication, let's say, on the part of our government with these space...
Oh, no.
The government is communicating with these people?
These space people have communicated with the government on many occasions.
In what way?
Well, they just simply came in and talked to them. To various officials of all governments.
The space people have come in and talked to officials of our government?
Of all governments in the world. They have not missed any.
Do you happen to know of any specific times that this occurred?
No, they didn't consult me. They just go right ahead. They don't ask
have you heard
permission at all?
I mean, did they speak to the president or did they appear in the Congress?
I have heard rumors, but it is of no interest to me whatsoever. And that's entirely up to the government. And
have you spoken with any of these space people?
No, I am not a contact. Not necessary in my case.
I'd like to get into another little area here, and that is this matter of belief. You mentioned before that you had read many things, and you gave this as proof, so to speak. In other words, who is this gentleman? Someone of the third ray, or
no? That's first ray.
That you had read. Have you read about this gentleman in books and so forth?
Well, since a great deal has been written about him over a matter of centuries, I think that it is quite possible that many persons have read about him.
Well, now, what I'm getting at is, does this offer to you convincing proof, proof enough that you can firmly believe in it, never having seen it, and having only, in other words, you have stories that you have heard, rumors that you have heard, things you have read. Now, is this enough to cause you to firmly believe in this thing?
Well, I don't know, because I never listen to rumors, and I don't pay very much attention to them.
Well, you mentioned that you heard rumors that these people had visited members of the government.
Oh, well, I thought you were talking about Moyer.
Well, I'm trying to get into the
thing of belief. Moyer is not a space fan. Now, what are we talking about?
I'm trying to get into this whole idea of the general area of belief, what you substantiate these beliefs with,
don't have any beliefs. I either know or I don't know. There is such a thing, when you get into these matters, there is such a thing as straight knowledge. Some people refer to it as intuition. And that is what you have to use when you get beyond a certain mundane level.
Is this something akin to, let's say, a Zen-Buddhism type of thing where I know it, and if you don't know it, the only way that you'll ever find out is to know it the way I do, and I can't teach you, but you just have to know it?
I know nothing about Zen-Buddhism.
No, it's this principle that it can't be taught. It's just a matter of sort of a universal wisdom or a knowledge that you know, even though you can't prove it.
Everything is a matter of universal wisdom.
Well, you see, what I'm getting at is we are in this age, the so-called space age, and it seems to me that all of these various devices and people and things that have happened in what I consider to be more or less of a offbeat field, these things are never able, there's no proof ever given for anything that ever happened. And all it is, we get back to the same thing. Well, I know it and that's it. And it would seem to me that it is, the situation has come to the point that if a man has a machine which can communicate with flying saucers, a radio-type machine, that if this gentleman is sincere in what he is doing, that there is no reason at all that he shouldn't make this knowledge available to the various or his own government. Because it would seem to me that no one man and no small group of people are going to be able to change the attitude of the United States government or the Canadian government. But if the governments themselves had access to a means of communication with the space people, then perhaps an agreement could be worked out whereby they could land peacefully and the whole thing could be accomplished with a much greater haste.
Well, in the first place, you seem to be assuming that Mr. Matthews is keeping this material secret. There's nothing secret about it. If anyone happens to be in his home at the time when the space people decide to send a message through, naturally it's just like having a radio turned on, and anyone who is there could hear it. There is nothing whatever secret about it, and Mr. Matthews has been most cooperative with me and has supplied me with all the material he has, which is published in my book. And so what's secret about it? I mean, no one...
Has he invited scientists and officials of the government to come and witness this?
He hasn't invited them. They
don't you think it's more
practically keep him up day and night with their visits up there.
And officials of the government have seen
officials
this in operation?
Of many governments have been in his home. What they have seen, I don't know. I doubt very much if space people would waste their time talking to the officials of the government.
Why would it be a waste of time?
Because they have already visited them, as I told you. And the governments of the world, without exception, have shown nothing but hostility.
Now, how do you know this? This is what I'm getting. Now, how do you know this? How can you make this statement over the air and with absolutely nothing to substantiate it?
Well...
Or do you have something that can substantiate it?
I have the knowledge of this.
How did this knowledge come to you from a space person, or is this a rumor?
I do not have any contacts with space people.
Is this a rumor?
No, it is not a rumor.
Was it told to you by someone?
Well...
Who witnessed it?
It has been told to me by many persons. Among others, Mr. Matthews himself has received complete messages on the space set about the activities of space people in connection with the various governments.
But have any government officials ever said anything to you about this? Or to any of your
friends? I don't know any government officials. I don't move in those circles.
Have any of your friends ever talked to any government official or anybody that you know where the government official has made this statement that they have been visited or they visited a friend and so forth?
I don't know any of my friends who talked to government officials, and if they did, I wouldn't be at all interested.
I would gather from your comments that you don't think too much of government officials.
I have no interest in the matter one way or the other, but I do feel that if the space people call on the government officials, that since this is a democratic country, that they should take advantage of the mediums of communication, newspapers, radio, and so forth, and give this out, at least give this out as news to the people.
If anything they have, I would agree with you.
Anything they know about flying saucers, they should give it out to the people and let the people judge.
You see, the thing, I could understand, let us say, one person or two people or many people in any government being corrupt or being narrow-minded or anything to in other words, that would not be considered, they wouldn't be upright and above board with all their knowledge. But it would seem to me that in the government system, as we have established it in this country and in other countries,
that there are people involved in this that are that have integrity and that would not be afraid to speak out. I couldn't possibly conceive of everyone in our government or any government wanting to withhold information from anybody.
You couldn't? Well, why don't you speak to some of the pilots of the various airlines, both government and private, who have seen many spaceships, and it has reached the point now where they dare not even report them.
Well, I've heard many reports from pilots.
They have been so ridiculed.
Well, this is a matter of public ridicule. It has nothing to do with the policy of the government, does it? Or the integrity of the individual concerned. At least they did make their statements known. Now, the fact that they were ridiculed, this has nothing to do with the official or the person concerned. This happens to be the attitude of the public.
No, I'm not speaking of the attitude of the public. It doesn't reach the public. How would it reach the public? It would have to go through newspaper channels.
No,
radio channels.
Reaching the public?
And
aren't you reaching the public right now?
Right now, yes. These cases that I am referring to involve pilots in government service. Now, there have been many, many stories about these things which have been published, perhaps not in the public press, in the daily newspapers, but certainly they have been published in many smaller publications, magazines, and so forth.
Now, isn't this reaching the public?
It's reaching a certain class of the public.
And what class is that?
Well, the people who read the smaller magazines and smaller publications, not the people who read the daily newspapers. The newspapers have not certainly carried very many saucer stories.
Not recently.
No, well, it's inconceivable to me that if all this were happening, and you know, the only place we hear about it is reading these smaller publications or listening to this particular program. Now, I know that John has quite a few listeners, and I'm sure that among these listeners there are many people, or several people, that would possibly be involved in governmental affairs or policy-making affairs, so forth and so on, whether on a city, state, or federal level. Now, I cannot accept the statement that officials of our government, I'm going to be specific now, that officials of our government have been visited by space people and that they have expressed an open hostility and an unwillingness to negotiate or to talk with these people, which is basically what you're saying, right?
They have expressed, certainly, hostility when they give orders to jet pilots to fire on...
I am not arguing with you the fact that this is an evidence of hostility, but my point is that perhaps this is because of the old fear of the unknown, perhaps because they haven't been visited by space people. They don't know what these things are, and they figure the only way they're going to find out is to shoot one and try to get it down to this planet. I can understand this. I'm not saying I condone it, but I can understand it. But I certainly feel that if it were possible to communicate, it's the same principle as going into Africa when you find a tribe of natives and you don't speak the language and you can't communicate. Many times hostilities arise. But if you can speak their language, if you can talk to them, then possibly you can work out an arrangement which will be agreeable to both sides.
Well... The space people, of course, are completely telepathic. And last year, when I was on this program, there was some suggestion made that perhaps Mr. Matthews could bring his set down here to New York and demonstrate. I wrote to Mr. Matthews about this, and he spoke to the space people about it. And they said it would just be a complete waste of time because they would simply say, so-called scientists and so forth who were listening to this, would simply say that it was some kind of a trick. They wouldn't understand why, but they would say that it was a trick. After all, the space people know the minds of the people. They are able to take complete readings and estimates. They know just what the status of the entire population is in that respect. And when the people are ready, that is, when
This is 710 on the dial. WOR Radio, New York City.
Earthlings, yes. When a sufficient number are ready to accept this, then the space people will be able to land peacefully. Meanwhile, they are not anxious to cause any difficulties at all, any trouble.
Meanwhile, what would happen?
Well,
supposing they landed today.
Well, the people have not had a chance to have sufficient preparation. If the newspapers and radios and TV and so forth, they would all cooperate and allow the people, just simply tell the people what is observed and so forth, and allow the people to become accustomed to the idea of life on other planets, then the people would have some preparation. As it stands, they have had very little preparation, except in a certain rather small circle.
Don't you think, Mrs. Storm, that it would be rather ridiculous for any newspaper, any radio station, or any television station to go out on a limb and to tell their listeners that there are people living on other planets, that we know it, when no proof has ever been offered to
any
editor,
or
to any radio camera?
They wouldn't prove that. Anyway, Mr. Tesla, I wouldn't say that no proof has ever been offered. Mr. Tesla was willing to go out on a limb in 1938 and design an interplanetary communication set.
Let me ask you this, Mrs. Storm. If you design an interplanetary communication set, what does this mean if there's no one to communicate with?
Well, it doesn't mean anything, but he said that spaceships would be approaching the Earth from other planets, and then the set would provide...
All right, that was 1938. This is 1958, 20 years elapsed. Now, let me ask you this question. Forgetting about Tesla for a moment, has any proof ever been offered to you, Mrs. Storm? In other words, if you owned this radio station, would you tell your news commentators that each day they should tell the listeners of WOR that the space people will be here, will be coming here, let's prepare?
No, I think, however, that all sightings should be treated as news and should be reported as news.
Do you honestly feel that there are saucers flying around, or spacecraft, or whatever you
want
to call it?
Mm-hmm.
Even
though Mr. Carr hasn't got his up in the air yet.
Well, Mr. Carr is the only person, I think.
But may I make an observation here?
Never can tell about that.
Mr. Tesla, of course, started this on the space principles in 1925.
Well, Mr. Carr, I'd just like to tell you that maybe if you have a night or two once in a while to spare, you should sit up and listen to the... You should stay up and listen to the party line, because we've had people that tell us that this goes back many, many more years prior to the time of Mr. Tesla.
Very possible. What we wanted to further say is that after many years of development, we found a power package that made it possible to build an electrified craft. Having succeeded in doing this, we then observed an unidentified electrified craft in the air. We saw four from 1951 to 52, and myself, I'm speaking editorially. Now, having experimented, having run successful tests, our first feeling was that, well, our work has been completed. Someone else has done it. The governments, or the United States government, or other scientists have finally found the electrical propulsion system and put it to work. And we were a little chagrined, but nevertheless we were happy to see these functioning craft. As months went by, and from months to years with no identification, we, without having the exact knowledge of having talked to or had communication, most assuredly had the feeling that they must be from out of space, because we would not be spending the millions and the billions on antiquated rockets if we had an electrical propulsion system so superior to it. And we have seen
In our observation, one of these craft had a velocity of several thousand miles per hour, and we are a trained observer.
You're using the editorial way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When you say that you're a trained observer, where did you receive this training?
Observation.
What does that mean?
The study of meteors and their flight for many years.
You have been studying that for
many years? That's right, many years. And the various other objects that are in the air, visible in the heavens at night. Therefore, when we see something going at great velocity, spinning, throwing off an electrical glow, because we have seen this glow ourselves, we know this to be an object that is not a heavenly body because it seemed to have been controlled.
Do you think, Mr. Carr, that there are Venusians, Martians, Saturnians walking around on this planet?
There is a great possibility that this is true. The trained observer knows that all forces of any value at all are reasonably invisible until they are understood.
They may be here now, but they're invisible.
This could be. And they could be visible.
Are there any visible Martians walking around?
It is very possible. We have not talked to any.
But they may be here.
Very possible.
Why is it that we haven't talked to them?
Maybe they don't want to talk to us.
In other words, then they must be invisible then.
Otherwise,
we'd recognize something. Are they in a different form other than...
You have to approach this in a little bit of a psychological...
That is the most unfortunate part about all of these subjects. We wind up with a psychological and a physical approach instead of a tangible.
Well, we can make it both tangible, too, by comparison.
How do you compare something that's invisible with something
that's
visible?
It doesn't necessarily have to be invisible. It could be very visible.
Well, you have a good example right in your two hands there with those magnets. You're holding two tangible pieces of metal, and when you put the north poles near each other, you feel a definite pressure between the two in what appears to us to be blank, empty space, and yet you feel the force. You can't see it. It's there.
The other comparison I was coming to make is this, that you and I don't every day go down in the Everglades swamps and play with the alligators and the cottonmouths, because that isn't an abominable situation for us. And it's very possible that anyone, any being of a higher evolved state would think they're the same way about us as we think about these places that we don't want to visit. So,
why is it, Mr. Carr, that everybody that I have the opportunity of talking to who talks about Venusians, Martians, Saturnians, Clarions, and what have you, always tell us that they're higher evolved than what we are? They have a different... I don't doubt that their culture may be different than ours. But we're constantly told that they're superior to us. Why is this, sir?
If they're able to come here and we aren't able to go to
them. If they are. Of course, this doesn't prove that they're superior.
No, not necessarily.
I saw a fellow the other night who we put dough into his eyes, cotton over the dough, and then put around an elastic bandage, and then we put five napkins around, and the man read something... I think the man is superior, possibly when it comes to eyeless vision, but it ends there.
Could be.
And because the man, just because you have invented something, Mr. Carr, that you claim will take us to the moon and back in a period of 10 hours, does not mean that you're superior to me, sir.
Not at all.
It means that you have more knowledge about the development of this craft, the... aluminum foil craft or whatever it is, or the circular foil craft.
Right.
This puts us on a level then with the space people, because now we can go too.
Yes. So if we could develop, you notice that in our rendering, architectural rendering, that we have plenty of space for space people to land. We have a landing field there. They are invited when we get it built.
Have they made any reservations?
Well, we don't have any.
Because the space is there when they come in.
That's right.
Mr. Carr, you mentioned a few moments ago about these tests that you had performed. Could you give us some idea of what some of these tests involved?
Our tests involved
proving this principle to be accurate, wherein we electrified a circular assembly of electromagnets, capacitor plates, an electrified propulsion system. We got it to a state of relative velocity, and it became airborne. We run successful tests. Out of this, we were able to build the basic engineering principle that makes it possible for us to build a craft weighing many tons that will absolutely be airborne in the fact that it will neutralize its inertial attractive force. And insofar as this attractive force is concerned, it is totally weightless, regardless of how much it weighs.
Have you still got this equipment that you perform these tests with?
We have much of our equipment.
Could you do the test tomorrow, the same test?
It would take a couple of days.
Do you think that this might be desirable for you to do, possibly getting it back again, possibly to the government, because they seem to have a lot of money to throw around?
The government is not at all interested in that. We have told the government exactly what we want to do, what we plan to do, and what we are going to do. A government scientist has visited our workshop. The scientist agreed with us publicly, with other people. He was certain that a craft such as we described could become electrically airborne. But the government published the statement that they were that what we have does not fit their foreseeable needs.
Why do you think the government isn't interested? You say that what
Bill,
you...
let me pick that question up from you, will you?
Fine.
I'm sitting here in...
Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, Mr. Neville. What John might characterize as straight-faced amusement, diction contradiction. We deal with a lot of terms that confuse us around this table, and I'm sure must consequently confuse some of the audience. And if it's eight, I think it's probably closer to 800,000 or 8 million from his mail and our mail. I'd like to try to reduce some of this to understandable simplicity and terms which have common meaning. In the first place, we talk about space people as though they were something foreign to ourselves. It may be a surprise to some of us right here at this table to begin to consider us as truly space people, as any people who may populate some other planet. We think of this Earth planet that we're tied to by a gravity pull as our own home, as peculiar to us, and as having certain particularities like an atmosphere, and that there is nothing else like it anywhere. We sometimes forget that in spite of the fact that we have a little atmosphere, we are as truly in space as people on the moon or Mars or Venus standing on the surface of their planet would be in space. John has two helical magnets in his hand. These magnets, when held so that their north poles are near each other, repel each other. This is a simple demonstration of how Mr. Carr's invention of a circular coil craft is propelled away from this planet or any other planet by a circular motion machine, a power package as we call it, which develops in the craft itself a polarity and a pressure potential, which while it's larger than the force you feel in these two little magnets, it is identical in basic principle. Now, if you understand a basic principle, you can understand any machine that is developed from that principle or built around it.
How do you control? I noticed that if you take a magnet and you put the two north poles together, that the other magnet shoots off, but it has no particular direction. It's liable to go anyway as long as it gets away. Now, how do you control this particular spacecraft?
I'll be glad to show you that in just a minute.
You want to use these?
Sure. The force that is felt when you put these two North Poles near each other is a sample of the force we call free space energy. It is an energy that's all around us and available to us. It is the same energy that is used in the more familiar electric generators, dynamos, and motors. We don't manufacture it. We merely use systems to collect it, focus it, and distribute it. And so we can do it with these two little magnets, just as we do it with the circular foil spacecraft, by a system of counter-rotation. The two little paper clips I have here, just like any other paper clips, I picked them up out of a box of many. As you see, they're not magnetic. They don't attract each other. They don't repel each other. Each of these paper clips is attracted with equal force to either of these North Pole tips of these Alnico magnets. And if you hold the magnets with the paper clips on the ends so that they are opposite and in a parallel plane with each other, you continue to see this phenomenon of the magnets pushing each other away or repelling, the mutual repulsion of like poles. And if you turn the two magnets so that the paper clips are perpendicular to each other, forming sort of a cross as you bring them close together, you feel no push, so that you have thereby controlled, by redirecting the flow of this free space energy along the paper clips so that they no longer push each other apart. And as you gradually turn them parallel and perpendicular, you feel the force of repulsion stronger and weaker. And as they're perpendicular, it's completely neutralized. There's no push at all. We accomplish the same control of space force in the circular foil craft by accelerating or decelerating the system of counter-rotation. And you could call these two little magnets, call one of them Earth, call one of them Moon, or call one of them Earth and call the other OTCX-1 spacecraft. You put them in a certain relationship to each other, and they push each other apart. When the OTCX-1 is put into rotation relative to the Earth's rotation, it will push the Earth away, and the Earth will push it away. So that this is a very simple demonstration that anyone can make with his own two hands of how the free space energy can be used to propel a craft away from Earth and anywhere in the solar system.
Bill Preston?
I notice when you use these magnets for this particular demonstration, I think it's almost better than the thing with the sugar, you know, the cubes of sugar.
Yeah.
I noticed that this magnetic field has a certain limit, and that once this other magnet is outside of this limit, that this principle no longer operates. Now, does this same thing hold true with this free space energy, or is it just all around?
Well, the universal laws that apply to these two little quarter-inch diameter magnets apply to all bodies in the solar system according to their mass. And that is expressed in the inverse proportion laws of gravity and magnetism. They are what we call stronger and weaker as we go closer to them or farther away from them.
Don Dunn.
Mr. Carr, you said a small model of the ship had become airborne.
This is correct.
You got this model spinning?
Yes, indeed.
With what kind of force was used to spin the model?
Electromotive.
By that, you mean an electric motor?
Electricity from our Utron electrical accumulator.
Did this Utron accumulator become plugged into any kind of socket or wall, sir?
No need. It is in the vernacular a battery. It's a storage cell, an accumulation of storage cells.
How big was the model that became airborne?
The model was approximately, one was 4 feet in diameter, one was 4.5, and the largest model we built was 6 feet.
What did it weigh?
The largest one was approximately 16 pounds.
What did the battery weigh?
The battery... was about 2.5 pounds. That is the accumulator.
Mm-hmm.
Weighed about 2.5 pounds.
That's about the ratio of 1 to 8.
Now, the electromagnets took up most of the weight. We had about 12 ounces of balsa wood as the frame.
What will be the weight of the first X?
OTCX-1, as we planted at Space Maryland Space Research Institute, will be 45 feet in diameter and weigh approximately 15 tons.
And you'll need about a 2-ton battery to lift it.
It will, and it'll have, we plan, a 12,000-volt output to this battery, this accumulator.
Good for a flashlight, I can tell you that. You'd have a bright light.
Mm-hmm.
This is WOR Radio. Waiting for me there? This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and this is Long John with the Party Line. My guest this morning, Mrs. Margaret Storm, the author of the new book entitled Return of the Dove, Otis T. Carr and Norman Colton of OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland. Mr. Carr is president of OTC Enterprises. Norman Evans Colton is director of sales engineering. Charles Leadham, author and TV producer, is with us. Don Dunn of Television Age and William E. Preston, Jr. Charles, we've got a couple of telegrams there. Do you want to... read those?
This one says, it's from Norwalk, Connecticut. The lady would like her name not to be read. Marvelous program, but I beg to differ with the gentleman who said that man had never created life, even an amoeba. I read that in 1600, a simple scientist accidentally found life in a solution. He was almost stoned to death by simple peasant neighbors. This life could not reproduce. That's the end of that telegram.
All right. Thank you very much. Anybody want to comment on this?
Dr. Kreil of Cleveland made a little bit of progress in pork fat with the development of a cell. How far he went, we don't know.
Charles?
Let's see. There's a rather long one here. From New York, thank you and your guests for another interesting program. However, with all due respect to you and your panel, whose intelligence, acumen, and humor are admirable in your justifiably skeptical approach, you seem to be woefully ill-equipped to question the technical aspects of this discussion. Oh, where art thou now, Major Markov, or someone of similar background? In reference to question Don raised just before coffee break, Einstein, in his classic equation, had suggested that energy and mass are the same. In 1931, two physicists, Cockcroft and Walton, bombarded lithium with protons and found that alpha particles were ejected with tremendous energies. This energy, they found, was equivalent to the decrease in total mass. Thanks again for a good show. Signed, Jules Francis.
I stand corrected.
I don't know about that.
How do you feel about it, Charles?
Well, I, on this bit of no one here being, or of everyone here being woefully equipped to question the technical aspects of this discussion, I don't feel woefully equipped. Apparently, Mr. Francis thinks so.
I'd like to interpolate that while the gentleman's remarks are very fine and well-intentioned, that... they are self-contradictory in that if you are giving him a good show, your questions, however inept they may be, are bringing out the answers that make the show.
I, for one, like your questions, and I think you're eminently qualified.
One and all.
We feel the same way, and all great developments are usually basically simple and are easily understood by ordinary language. Faraday's great discovery of rotating a loop of wire inside two poles of a magnet, which really made possible electric motors and introduced more than anything else in the world the electrical age. Now, we're confident that almost every child who has done any experiment has built the Faraday motor. Children can do it. Yet, believe me, it was for years before anyone would even listen to him, and even after the English government
he tried to get a small appropriation, and they said to him, well, what good is this anyway? And his classic reply was that someday you will tax it.
We have another telegram here, the personal census telegram.
Has requested me not to use their name. Here's the message. Ask him. I imagine that the person is referring to either Mr. Colton or Mr. Carr. Ask him if the $20 million will be returned to the investors if the OTCX1 fails to reach the moon and return. In other words, I guess the person is interested in knowing whether they will receive a written guarantee that the unit will work. In other words, a 90-day guarantee or 93 million miles.
Getting back to our conversation a few minutes ago,
you're going
to
drop this
I'm going to pick that right up. We established two.
This is not my question, as you realize.
I understand.
This is one that came in by the wire. What's our dream?
Right. I have tried to establish that we are space people. That we have.
Are you talking now about OTC?
I, Norman Colton, and he, Otis T. Carr, we acknowledge that we are space people.
We're traveling on
a fast moving planet here that is not visibly suspended by any wires,
hooks, structure or framework of any kind that we can see. It's spinning on its axis at about 660 miles an hour. It's rotating in its orbit around the sun at about 66,000 miles an hour. So I think we're as much space people as anybody. We have approached our government. We have shown them these prototype principles, the two magnets that you are holding in your hands that I think you acknowledge clearly demonstrate the existence, the availability and controllability of the free space energies we talk about. And five eminent government officials were visited by us space people, and they in turn visited our Baltimore headquarters. We made them these demonstrations and many more. They orally acknowledged that what we had shown them, Mr. Carr had invented, applied as principle to a more refined structure to be built from those principles as an electrified spacecraft could be airborne and spaceborne. And a few days later, after they returned to Washington, some party unknown to us by name issued a statement to the press that, as I read it here, when it was published in the Philadelphia Inquirer, that the model shown does not meet the present or foreseeable needs of the Army. Now, the model
this
shown...
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the dial.
Alnico magnets, little motors, little generators, little assemblies of components that demonstrated principles which they had acknowledged would perform if manufactured substantially and structurally to perform as airborne craft. And yet they restricted their comment to the models shown, which were not intended to be flight-worthy craft by any means. This is a long way around to your wire that questioned whether we would return the $20 million. The direct answer to the question is that we won't even collect the $20 million until we have made a successful demonstration not only of principle, but of flight worthiness of a small prototype model of the craft.
Mr. Colton, I haven't mentioned the person's name that sent that telegram. So I don't think that I am taking unfair advantage of the person because they're not with us this morning. I think what this person means is if a group of people buy stock
In other words, if this becomes a public stock, if this is a public stock offer, and if the people buy $20 million worth of stock, and the craft never gets off the ground, are they going to get their money back?
Well, there
well,
again.
I think I can answer that myself. Certainly not. I mean, after all, any time anybody invests in a firm, I mean, the money is going to be used to build the craft, and if something happened that it failed, well, it would be one of those unfortunate things.
You're certainly right in the ordinary commercial sense and in the ordinary sense of venture stock offerings. We have restricted ourselves again to guarantee that we will make a public demonstration of the actualities that we speak about here before we even offer the public a single share of stock. We will not collect any public funds, either in the form of stock investment or in the form of appropriations from tax monies, before we have made a physical demonstration of these principles in a flight-worthy craft. Recently, we reiterated these attitudes in a telegram which said to all concerned in government and in the public communications media, attention invited, our standing proposal, furnish government practical electrified spacecraft. Money, no object. Weight, no problem. Size, immaterial. Instrumentation, optional. Let McElroy name it. We will build it, man it, deliver it COD. Risk-free offer still stands. Scientific investigation still invited. Question motivation, government disinterest. Request public hearing immediately. Now, this telegram was sent to officials of government and to a long list of public communications media, including the three press wire services used by most newspapers. We have not seen a word of this message published. Some radio stations aired the message, but we have not had any visits from government officials. We have not had any visits from scientists, physicists, or any other people who wanted to challenge our statements there that we would like anyone interested who is in a position to and willing to back up his interest with some kind of support or participation or the ability to write an order for a craft to come to our establishment and either make us prove or disprove.
I think Mr. Croton, I have been browsing since the very first 30 minutes that we talked the last time. I think that I don't know anything about your background as far as but I think that you're a great publicist, a great public relations man.
If I ever received this telegram, I would use it. And I know that a lot of stations around the country possibly did use it because it's a great telegram. It's just the type of thing to end off a 15-minute news bit. Now, let me just ask you this. Do you honestly think that if the government decided, I think you told us that you did send this to the president,
to
the vice president,
to the responsible government officials who have anything to do with the acquisition of such craft, such as the cabinet members, the cabinet officers for commerce, interior, defense, so forth.
All right. Supposing that the government, I don't even know if they're in a position to, I don't know enough about the
running of a government, but if they could take you up on this offer,
you know as well as I do, man.
that you couldn't manufacture this on a COD basis.
You see, the way we
look, I don't know, unless you fellas are already...
Yeah, there's no mystery to it.
Finance. Unless you have the capital, I doubt it. That's a lot of money, $20 million, man.
We don't propose to manufacture the 45-foot full-scale device without some prior preparation. What we say is this. Let's say you are Secretary McElroy.
Mm-hmm.
You sit across the table from me as a representative of OTC Enterprises.
I'd like to pick up my... Sermon Adams, and I need a new coat to sit in.
And let me say at this point that I want to thank you for your kind remarks, and the admiration is mutual. Mutual.
That's what. Go ahead.
You're McElroy or Sherman Adams or whomever is qualified and authorized to write out an order for a prototype circular foil spacecraft.
On a COD basis.
On a COD basis. You write the order, which, of course, we understand is backed up by Treasury funds.
Right,
when the product is delivered, we can cash the check.
Not just delivered, say.
Well, demonstrated, orbited, so forth, according to specifications and requirements as set up. You write the order, and you hand it to the man at the end of the table, who we'll say would be the trust officer of a substantial bank, or a representative of the American Arbitration Association, or some other disinterested third party who would hold that order in escrow.
Mm-hmm.
We would then, before we pick up the order, and before we saddle you with that commitment to deliver us any funds at any time under any circumstances, we would make a demonstration of a miniature matter, say 5-foot diameter or 10-foot diameter, which we can manufacture in a matter of days for a few thousand dollars. Then, when we make
can I interrupt you, Ed? Could you be a little more definite?
More definite?
Yeah, when you say a few thousand dollars.
A few thousand dollars.
Is that $7,500
of intrinsic cost for a 10-foot prototype model. Now, this is not
the... What do you mean by intrinsic?
Well, the dollar value on today's markets of the copper and iron and duralumin and so forth that go into the craft itself, known in commerce as direct costs for the commodities. Now, added to that is the indirect cost, the overhead, the travel and subsistence and so forth, all of which we estimate would amount to no more than $30,000.
$30,000 is the price, then.
Right, of a miniature model.
Mm-hmm.
We would demonstrate that miniature model, which would, in all respects, be relatively equal to the full-scale craft. It would not have guidance systems. It would not have crew comfort facilities and accommodations. But it would satisfactorily demonstrate everything we've claimed about its ability to achieve self-propulsion and space flight.
Mr. Fuller, what speed would it fly at?
Speed is hypothetical. It would depend on how fast you'd want to rotate it and how far away you'd want to send it. If you put it into the same orbital path that the Sputniks are in, it would be going at a speed of 18,000 miles an hour, because once it achieves its relative rotation and gets out a certain distance from its attractive mass, it becomes powered by free space forces, and its speed of flight is then proportionate to its rotation and its distance from the mass.